Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hello. We're almost there.
All right.
Hey, long time no hear.
Yeah, how you doing?
Doing well. Super excited to hear you again.
Well, I'm alive. That's about it.
Oh, man, I hear you.
Yeah, we're a couple minutes early yet anyway, so...
Well, I'm going to start recording about 30 seconds. No, actually, right now.
Okay.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to a special edition Thursday night here, Wednesday night, excuse me, here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're pleased to bring back an information provider from some of our past shows, returning again, very excited, on the subject of credit cards, Mr. Michael Maris. My name is Martin. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do were they similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the Rules of Civil Procedure, better known to some as American Jurisprudence or AMJUR. The Rules of Civil Procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on and virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course, so it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of your remedies in the law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights. Anything that you can think of. If it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social network, though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Well, maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. I mean, for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button, fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night the calls go out over here at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at Your Remedy is in the Law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best. And believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen. And when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not at Your Remedy is in the Law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, I thank you for that disclaimer. It's important that we have these disclaimers because it's, I believe, the one thing that has kept the government from contacting me and saying, you're practicing law without a license. Because we're telling you, if you're here for legal advice, go away. It can't be more clear than that. Anyways, What we're going to be talking about tonight, just a quick 30,000-foot view, is that there is an entity, it's called an LLC, that Mr. Slevin has and his team have put together that, in the short statement, is an entity that is not required to file a tax return. This is a turnkey presentation to you, meaning that once you hire Mr. Slevin and his team to craft this LLC for you, they put together everything, the bank accounts, the merchant processing by way of using Cash App and something called Square, and as well as opening the bank accounts and just basically everything. You provide them the name, and they go from there. They provide the EIN number for the accounts. Everything. It's turnkey, and so the end result is that you may operate your business that you would normally do through this, and the end result is you're not having a tax footprint generated from it. We further suggest that you augment this by utilizing two charitable religious trusts that Bernie provides that each owns 50% of the share. So you've got your first stop gap is this LLC that Mr. Slevin prepares. The second stop gap is the charitable religious trusts, the CRTs, that are identified by the IRS as non-taxpayers. And then prayerfully, you will have also corrected your status to become an American national from a United States citizen. So in the third place, there's also not a federal tax responsibility. All this said and done, you can operate like this for as long as you need to, but should you ever wish to go into what is referred to as the Golden Horseshoe, which is like the Moab, the mother of all bombs, if you would, with regards to asset protection, then everything that Mr. Slevin has done and the two charitable religious trusts become the keys to fitting right into the Golden Horseshoe. There is nothing that is equal to or superior that I have ever found to this. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn this call over to Mr. Slevin.
Good evening.
Oh. You sound like some bloodsucker.
Hey, don't be accusing me of being a tax man. That's just really, that's mean, okay? Hi, guys.
That's through me.
Hey,
all right,
you have fun, don't
out.
Go.
I'm muting out. Have fun.
Good idea. Bye. Well, good evening, folks. This is Harry Slevin here, and I'd like to talk to you today about how things really work and how you can do it better, because all we ever want to do is get better, right? So the organic document of this country is the Declaration of Independence. It was published in July 4th, 1776, and this is probably the most often quoted portion of the document. Quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem to be most likely to affect their safety and happiness." Folks, I suggest that you read this, the whole declaration, every so often. It's a masterful work in reason. Now, reason, with a capital R, is this extraordinary process of logically moving from point A to point B to solve a problem. Or, as it says in Isaiah 1:18, quote, "Come now, let us reason together, says the Lord. Though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they are red like crimson, they shall become like wool. End quote. Now think about the symmetry and the mastery of those words. You have the two ends of the spectrum, scarlet and white. And the evidence thereof is just, it's mind-boggling. But in order to go from there, you must reason your way through. So what I propose to do tonight is reason our way through from where we find ourselves to be tax slaves of the District of Columbia, and some would say physical slaves as well. We can reach a point where we are not, where we are truly free men and women. So after we declared independence from England and the monarchy thereof, that sovereignty that the kings and queens of England said was their divine right, that sovereignty devolved upon each of us and our forebears, rather, and because of them to us. And this comes in probably one of the best places from Chisholm v. Georgia, 1793, Supreme Court case on page 471. It says, quote, "The same feudal ideas run through all their jurisprudence and constantly remind us of the distinction between the prince and the subject. No such ideas obtain here. At the Revolution, the sovereignty devolved on the people, and they are truly the sovereigns of the country. But they are sovereigns without subject, unless the African slaves among us may be called so, and have none to govern but themselves. The citizens of America are equal as fellow citizens and as joint tenants in the sovereignty." Here we plainly see that Americans, by the virtue of this declaration, that subsequent armed conflict, that this sovereignty, and they are sovereign. They are truly free men. In other words, we each own ourselves. Our bodies and the production thereof are entitled to each of us and us alone. However, that freedom or liberty, if you will, also carries great responsibility. Whereas the authority of this entitlement empowers us to make contracts, we must strictly consider that by making these agreements, one can easily trade away their production and the body as well for mere promises. The one that often comes to mind is the promise of security. Anybody out there ever hear of social security? Noting that, we must remember that the wise Benjamin Franklin, who once wrote, "Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety." If you don't think, you're just in a tank. Now, we also must remember the words of the ancient warrior who said, "Choose wisely," when offered a benefit in trade for a birthright. As reference, you might look at Genesis 25:29-34, and see where Esau sold his birthright, which was a magnificent thing, for nothing more than a bowl of porridge, because he didn't value it. And if you don't value something, chances are you're going to lose it. So let's look a second here at this parenthetical comment that was in Chisholm about the African slaves. Now, Chisholm was written in 1793, and from all accounts, the Supreme Court seems to have left the Negro out in the cold. Now, the Constitution did address the slave trade in Article 1, Section 9, Clause 1, quote, "The migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit shall not be prohibited by the Congress prior to the year 1808, but a tax or duty may be imposed on such importation, not exceeding $10 for each person." Now, that portion of the Constitution was codified by the Act Prohibiting Importation of Slaves in 1807. This act is the United States federal law that provided for that no new slaves were permitted to be imported into the United States. And it took effect on January 1, 1808, which, of course, was the earliest date permitted by the U.S. Constitution. However, that did not change things internally to the several states of the Union. So as there was a great expansion in the early 1800s, there became this division of the USA into free states and territories, as well as slave ones. The conflicting concepts finally came to the court in the infamous case Dred Scott v. Sanford, 1856. Now, this is the longest SCOTUS decision ever written. It's some 250 pages, and if you ever have insomnia, I would suggest trying to read it. You will go to sleep. Nonetheless, this case revolved around whether Dred Scott, who was a slave of Dr. Sanford and who had been given a wife with which he had had daughters, and the family had been transitioned through the free and slave areas, that Dred could use the courts to cement his freedom and get his family back. Now, the court ruled against Dred, but Mr. Justice Daniels stated this. This was an action, quote, "This was an action of trespass v. Armis instituted in a circuit court of the United States for the District of Missouri in the name of the plaintiff in error, which was Dred Scott, a Negro held as a slave for recovery of freedom for himself, his wife, and two children, also Negroes." So Judge Daniel wandered about a bit, but he came down to the writings of Justinian, which was a 6th century Roman emperor. So at page 479, it says this, quote, "The above account of slavery and its modifications will be found in strictest conformity." When you hear those words, strict conformity, that means it's right dead on top. Or let's see, as I said in Cousin Vinny, it's dead balls accurate. In strictest conformity with the Institutes of Justinian. Thus, in book 1st, title 3rd, it is said, quote, "The first general division of persons in respect to their rights is into free men and slaves," end quote. Same title, section 4, quote, "Slaves are born such or become so. They are born such of bond women." Remember that title. "They become so either by the law of nations or as by capture or by civil law." And in section 5, quote, "In the condition of slaves there is no diversity, but among free persons there are many. Thus some are ingenii, or freemen, and others are libertini, or freed men." And in the 4th degenerate it says, quote, "A free man is one who is born free of being born in matrimony." And when when Justinian was talking about a free man, it meant male or female, because man is a subset or a short for mankind. Back to it. "A free man is one who is born free for being born in matrimony of parents who are both free or both freed, or of parents, one free and the other slave. But one born of a free mother, although the father be a slave or unknown, is free." So then we look down, pop down here to the 13th Amendment, which was ratified on December 6, 1865, and it says, quote, "Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as punishment for crimes whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or in any place subject to their jurisdictions. Therefore, as we spoke of earlier, the bond or bond women of which these slaves were born in America, that bond for all women in America was extinguished by this amendment. So after that, anyone, any man, wombed or not, born in America after that date was indeed free. But they had to go and try and put this together. And that was with the 13th Amendment. Oh, just a note. This is the second 13th Amendment. So the following of this here can be found in the New Hampshire House Bill 638 in the 2013 session. And it says, quote, "In 1810, a proposed amendment to the United States Constitution, which prohibited titles of nobility and which later became known as the original 13th Amendment, was introduced, passed by both houses of Congress, and sent out to the states for ratification. On December 9th, 1812, shortly after the ratification by Virginia, New Hampshire became the 13th state to ratify the amendment. The amendment was therefore ratified by the requisite number of states and became the Article Article 13 of the United States Constitution. Article 13 reads, quote, if any citizen of the United States shall accept, claim, receive, or retain any title of nobility or honor, open paren, like a title of esquire, close paren, or shall, without the consent of Congress, accept or retain any present, pension, office, or emolument of any kind whatever from any emperor, king, prince, or foreign power, such person shall cease to be a citizen of the United States and shall be incapable of holding any office of trust or profit under them or either of them, end quote. Now, this is this has been consigned by the local media or the mainstream media, if you will, as a conspiracy theorist. But hello? The background noise going. So this is it might be one of the reasons that Washington City was burned by the British in 1812, and then there were some other financial interests that were going on. Anyway, that's just a little tangent there about maybe you were wondering how much you've been lied to. So let's go back to the 1865 version of the 13th Amendment. So we see it outlawed slavery, and therefore Justinian, according to Justinian, any member of mankind born in America was free because the bond was done of the mothers. The bond of the mothers was extinguished. So then the 14th Amendment came along and, using false pretenses, created a second kind of citizenship. This lowercase c citizen, United States citizen, or a citizen of the United States, if you will, and what is now known as, that is the second class citizen, and the premier class, or we the people, is now known as the American national. Now, due to the certification of the birth record and the application for a Social Security count, most Americans are truly a slave of the District of Columbia. Now, I highly suggest that getting that status changed, and so Mr. GW, who has a conference call on this channel, has the rock solid best way of doing that. No holds barred. It is the simplest I've ever seen. And it is, he has secured the exact place to send it. And in the military, we call that target identification. And once you have the coordinates, Katie bar their door, because you can bring a rain down on it. So, get GW's thing done, right? So let's go back to the Constitution. And in part of this earlier, it talked about how the Constitution actually allowed a tax upon the importation of slaves. So what kind of tax was that? We'll get to it. So the Constitution of the United States, which was ratified on June 21st, 1788, and then its Bill of Rights, and this really, folks, should be called the Bill of Restrictions, it would have erased a great deal of contention. Because when you read the first 10 amendments to the United States Constitution, to the Constitution for the United States, it says things like the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Isn't that a restriction? And just to show you how adamant they were about that, most people have seen the American flag, which, according to law, doesn't have anything around the edges of it. But you'll see in particularly federal courtrooms, you'll see a gold fringe all around the flag. And that's made up of a whole bunch of little threads. So for a right to keep and bear arms, not to be infringed, they're saying that you could not so much as take a pair of tweezers and pluck one of those many, many threads from around that flag. That's what infringement means. So they were adamant about it, and the Bill of Rights should be the Bill of Restrictions, and that way we wouldn't have to worry and have all these stupid discussions that people just kind of, you know, just keep fighting over. Anyway, so that brings us down to the District of Columbia Organic Act of 1871. And it's an act of Congress that repealed the individual charters for the cities of Washington and Georgetown and established a new territorial government for the whole District of Columbia. District of Columbia is ruled by Congress through the executive branch installed. It has a mayor and so forth and so on. All right. Now, some say upon that act, it also became, or right around that 1871 act, it also became a corporation. And this is supported by 28 USC 3002 definitions. As used in this chapter, United States means a federal corporation. So, you know, sounds like it to me. So what this act truly did on the global scale was it made Washington, D.C., or D.C. for short, a city-state, completely independent of all other states and or nations, and even though the ones that were surrounding it. It put it on par with the City of London. Now, the City of London is a one-square-mile enclave in Greater London, United Kingdom, as well as the Vatican City, which is a 110-acre parcel near the center of Rome, Italy. Now, these three city-states do, in fact, comprise the military, financial, and ecumenical power centers of the earth. And these folks that inhabit these things truly believe that they own everything and everybody. And they enforce this belief with merciless efficiency. Look at all the wars that have come about in the past, well, you say 1,000 years or 1,200 years for ease of use. They were all part of this construct of these city-states trying to assert their dominance upon us. I think most people, or the elite, now call us deplorables, or is that maybe not the latest one that they call us, but I like it anyway, because I am definitely deplorable. So just to show you a little evidence that D.C. ascended to a city-state, it started acquiring foreign property. So in 1889, the Spanish-American War broke out, and the use of Pearl Harbor grew in great importance. D.C. acquired the Hawaiian Islands as a territory from Stanford B. Dole of Dole Pineapple. Now, he had stolen it from Queen Liliuokalani in 1893 with the assistance of about 300 U.S. Marines. So as a result of the Spanish-American War, D.C. also acquired the properties of Cuba, Guam, the Philippines, and Puerto Rico. Cuba, which was set free, and that may have not been the best course because they still suffer from the Castro Revolution in the 1950s. Now, the Philippines escaped D.C. in 1946, and it's still a mess. So Guam and Puerto Rico remain territories of D.C., and there's some rather interesting agencies headquartered on those islands. One in Puerto Rico is the Internal Revenue Service. Yep, folks, the headquarters, the Internal Revenue Service is in Puerto Rico. And interesting, a compatriot of ours says that IRS is really Satan. You know, but that's his joke of the day. So D.C. specifically became a city-state by adopting a constitution. Now, it looks very much like the Constitution for the United States of 1788, but for one little word. The document adopted by D.C. is the Constitution of the United States. And when you listen to the talking heads on the TV and the Internet, they almost universally talk about the Constitution of the United States. Why? It's plain that the 1788 one was for the United States, because there is a difference, folks. And this difference is shown us in Wikipedia. Two of the most commonly used prepositions are of and for. These two, like all prepositions, indicate a relationship between objects in a particular sentence. Of is considered an old English preposition. It means away or away from. The preposition for, on the other hand, initially comes from before, which also means on account of. Therefore, the city-state of D.C. can be seen or as away from or without the union of the several states known as the United States of America. So we've thrown a lot of words and terms and stuff at you in these first few minutes. What I would like to show you is this all comes from what a group of people known as lexicographers, or lexicos for short. Now, these are wordsmiths, and another phrase for them are called legislative draftsmen. And the Supreme Court talked about these guys in a case called Merchants Loan and Trust v. Stempanka in 1921. At page 28, it says, in determining the definitions of the word income thus arrived at, this court has consistently refused to enter into the refinements of lexicographers or economists and has approved in the definition quoted what it is believed to be the most commonly understood meaning of the term, which must have been in the minds of the people when they adopted the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. Yeah, word salad. So they're telling the law, the lexicographers in lawyerly language, that you're a bunch of smarmy buggers and you're always out to deceive the people. And this is to the depth that they usually deceive the people. The FLESH index, that's spelled F-L-E-S-C-H, is a measure of English language, of comprehension of the English language, and it goes from 1 to 100. So as an example, a newspaper, standard newspaper you pick up on the street, is written about 8.5. A first-year college student understands about 11, and a law school graduate comprehends at nearly 15. The tax code, in particular, is written at an average of 33 with pieces as high as 55. So let's see, that's somewhere about 55 is somewhere roughly seven times the, or in order to understand things written at 55, you have to have seven times the acuum to read that you would need to read a newspaper. These folks have no intention of letting you know what is going on. All right, so this gives you a basis of who we're dealing with. So this goes a little bit back to the Constitution, and this is the justification about how you look at taxes. In order to be legitimate, the taxing statute must have three particulars. They are the subject of the tax, the measure of said tax, as well as a statement of liability. Now, a statement of liability is the most important, because if you don't know you're liable, if you don't know you owe something and somebody jumps up in your face, you're going to be very confused. And probably, particularly in my case, violence will ensue. So the Constitution for the United States of America designates two great classes of taxation. They are direct, which must be applied by apportionment, and indirect, which are required to be uniform throughout the several states. Now, just to be a little bit succinct, I'll read you the articles that address taxation. From Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3, quote, representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states, which may be included with the union, within this union, according to their representative numbers. So one of the reasons a census is so important, because it's not only about the House of Representatives, but direct taxes are based on those numbers. So from Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, the Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide the common defense and general welfare of the United States, but all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 4, no capitation, which is a head tax, no capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. Now, this clause refers to the tax on property, and at that time when the Constitution, the property was mainly land, but it was also slaves. So that links back to the earlier portion about the importation of slaves, a tax on them. Now, this clause, Article 1, Section 9, Clause 5. No tax or duty shall be laid on articles exported from any state. So, putting all that together, we came up with the three categories of taxables. You know, you have the classes of tax, which are direct and indirect, and then you have the three taxable categories. They are people, property, and activities. So direct taxes, as shown, are applied to people and to property via census, enumeration, and valuation. So obviously census enumeration is counting noses, and all the noses, the owners of each nose pays a tax. Evaluation is for property, particularly land. So you value the land. We'll say this acre of land costs $100,000 or is valued at $100,000. And then it's usually at the county level. The county says, okay, we're going to put a millage rate, which a mill is 1/1000th of a number. We're going to put a millage rate on of, say, 7. So that'd be 7.7%, I believe. And then, so on the $100,000, so the 10% would be $10,000, 1% would be $1,000, and 0.7% would be $700. So it would be $700 tax on a $100,000 acre of land, if you will. So that's how valuation works at the county level. And then wherever that tax goes, it goes once it's in their treasury. So that's direct taxation, people and property. So indirect taxation, and it's probably easier to use the word excise so you can mentally differentiate rather than using direct and indirect. We use direct and excise. And the only thing left is activities. So excise tax is placed on activities. But there has to be a way to measure the activity. So this has come down through time as calculating the production of said activity or placing a flat fee on something necessary to the process. So to demonstrate the measure of the tax, I will say, is there an excise tax on whiskey? Well, no, because whiskey is a product. It's a liquid. And so the excise tax can't be on the whiskey, but if it's not the subject of the tax, it's not really on whiskey, then the whiskey must be the measure of an activity. So what is the activity? That would be distillation. So the subject of the tax is the privileged activity of distillation. Now, some people will fight about, you know, whether it really is a privilege or not, but that's not for me to say. So the subject of the tax is the privilege of distillation, and the measure is the whiskey in its containers, whether it be, you know, quarts or pints or whatever. And we know that because every whiskey bottle that goes and is sold at retail has a little stamp around the lid to show that the tax has been paid, okay? So so that is one way of doing it, the production of distillation. Now, or they also can find, they can put a flat fee on the capacity of the distillery per year, all right? And if you don't believe me, you can go down in the Internal Revenue Code, in the alcohol taxes, and you will see exactly that. But either way, that gives you a really good idea of what an excise tax on an activity, and even though it may say it's on something, it's not really on that. That's the measure of it and not the subject of the tax. Okay. So along came the 16th Amendment, and it says, quote, "The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes, comma, from whatever source derived, comma, without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration." Okay, so as we just explained, direct taxes must be done by apportionment. So when the 16th Amendment talks about this taxes on income without apportionment, well, it can't be a direct tax. It must be an excise tax. All right? So even though it says it's on incomes, but income is not an activity. So it can't be the subject of the tax. It's got to be the measure of the tax. And we know this because 3 weeks after Congress gave themselves this power and sent it off to the states for ratification, which they knew it would have to have, they wrote this revenue law in 1909, and it popped up to a couple of cases. The first one was Flint v. Stone Tracy, and the other one was Stratton. From Stratton at 415, quote, "And however the operation shall be described, the transaction is indubitably business within the fair meaning of the Act of 1909, and the gains derived from it are properly and strictly income from the business. For income may be defined as gain derived from capital, from labor, or from both combined. And here we have the combination operations of capital and labor. As to the alleged inequity of operation between mining corporations and others, it is, of course, true that the revenues derived from the working of mines result in some, to some extent, to the exhaustion of the capital. But the same is true of the earnings of the human brain and hand when unaided by capital. Yet such earnings are commonly dealt with in legislation as income. So it may be said of many manufacturing corporations that are clearly subject to the Act of 1909, see that? Corporations that are clearly subject to the Act of 1909, especially of those that have to do with the production of patented articles, although it may be foretold from the beginning that the manufacturer will be profitable only for a limited time, at the end of which the capital value of the plant must be subject to material depletion. The annual gain of such corporations are certainly to be taken as income for the purposes of measuring the amount of tax." And then down at 417, they say, quote, "And the return, as in U.S. individual income tax return, shall be made under oath by the president and treasurer or other officers having like duties, indicating the clearest manner that it was to be set forth data that with the proper accounting would appear upon the books of the corporation." Now that's Stratton Independence v. Hobart in 1913. So because Congress is barred from taxing anything that sustains our right to life, as is stated in the Declaration of Independence, they have to put this taxes on something that must be applied for or chartered. And this was revealed in Flint v. Stone Tracy, which was done in 1910 and 11. So from Flint at 151, quote, "The tax under consideration, as we have construed the statute, may be described as an excise upon the particular privilege of doing business in the corporate capacity, with the advantages which arise from corporate or quasi-corporate organizations, or, when applied to insurance companies, for doing business of such companies." Now, doing business can be doing business, carrying on business, or transacting business in today's vernacular. So at 152, it makes this beautiful statement. "If business is not done in the manner prescribed in the statute, no tax is payable. Then we jump down to 161, and we find this. "In the case at bar, we have already discussed the limitations which the Constitution imposes upon the right to levy excise taxes, and it could not be said, even if the principles of the 14th Amendment were applicable to the present case, that there is no substantial difference between the carrying on of business by the corporation taxed and the same business when conducted by a private firm or individual. The thing taxed is not the mere dealing in merchandise, which is the actual transaction, though in which the actual transaction may be the same, whether conducted by individuals or corporations, but the tax is laid upon the privilege which exists in conducting business with the advantages which inhere to the corporate capacity of those taxed, and which is not enjoyed by private firms, private partnerships, or individuals. So all of that comes down in today to Section 701 of the Internal Revenue Code. A partnership as such shall not be subject to the income tax imposed by this chapter, period. Now that happens to be Chapter 1 of the Internal Revenue Code, and that title is Normal Taxes and Surtaxes. So these Congress in 1913 did a shorthand version, because Flinty Stone Tracy allowed them to leave off the excise tax and the with respect to doing business in the corporate capacity. So they just got to say it's a tax on income of 1% all for all citizens, lowercase c, citizens of the United States and so forth. And then on the normal tax is laid on corporations. And then they got the thing and they said not including partnerships. So that's why 701 says partnerships as such shall not be subject to income tax. So now you probably heard that, you know, when you're reading the statutes, the Internal Revenue Code particularly, you know, you have to understand the rules of construction. And this is something that the lexicos and legislative draftsmen are absolutely schooled in it. And the first, probably the most important one, is that anytime the legislatures define a word or phrase into a term, then you must use that term definition when reading the statute. Webster's no longer applies. All right? So, we see a partnership shall not be subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter. This is the second sentence, and it ties us back to the 1909 case. And it says, quote, persons carrying on business as partners shall be liable for income tax only in their separate or individual capacities. So we see a couple of terms here. Now, you don't know these are terms unless you're taking the time to read this stuff. Unfortunately, I have. Probably got two PhDs studying this stuff. Heaven help me. Anyway, we see a couple of terms here. Persons and partnerships. Both are terms. All right. So where are these terms defined? Well, that was Section 701. You have to go way over to 7701. And we find definitions, all right? So A, when used in this title, where not otherwise distinctly expressed or manifestly incompatible with the intent thereof, one, person. The term person shall be construed to mean and include an individual, a trust, estate, partnership, association, company, or corporation, all right? So then we see A2, and it reads, in part, the term partnership includes an unincorporated organization. Do you remember the little thing called private firm back there from Flint? So I'll throw this one in now. You'll love it. So, way down to A20 of the same section, 7701, we find the term employee. This is art, folks. This is all you can say about this. So, quote, for the purposes of applying the provisions of Section 79 with respect to group term life insurance purchased by, and so forth and so on, for another 109 words, we find this, the term employee shall include a full-time life insurance salesman who is considered an employee for the purposes of Chapter 21. Now, Chapter 21 is where FICA is found. All right. FICA is called the Federal Insurance Contribution Act, which comes from the Social Security Act of 1935. Let's go on down that path for a second. So the Act of 1935 was created in 11 separate titles. Now, this was done by FDR, who knew full well that this act was unconstitutional. And the reason they did that was to keep at least some of this their socialist agenda alive. So FDR knew that by doing it with 11 separate titles, if one title fell, then the others would stand. So remember back in the 1909 law, which there's a tax upon income with respect to doing business in the corporate capacity? Well, here, listen to this. So from Title II, the Federal Old Age Benefits and Old Age Reserve Act, Section 201A, there is hereby created an account in the Treasury of the United States to be known as the Old Age Reserve Account, hereafter in this title called the account. And then it goes on to say that this account is for qualified individuals, and then it defines qualified individuals. And so it also gives the Secretary of Treasury, at the Secretary of Treasury's discretion, they get to fund this account. So this account is not yours. You know, that's been the big thing, you know, over time. It was always talked about my Social Security account. No. It's an account for a qualified individual that comes up because some human applies for it and gets involved in this thing. And then the Secretary of Treasury funds it. And if none of the funds are, to be used in the next year, then they are allowed to be invested. And I can show you a website that you can put your Social Security or anybody's Social Security number into, and it will show you how many entities and individuals out there have invested in that account. So all of this, you know, has these high and mighty things, but what it is, it's a money-making operation for the United States. That's all it is. So the tax, we talked about Chapter 21 in FICA. Okay, so the FICA tax actually comes from Title 8 of the 1935 Social Security Act. Okay, so we look down here in Title 8, Section 801. In addition to other taxes, there shall be levied, collected, and paid upon the income of every individual a tax equal to the following percentages of the wages received by him after December 31st, 1936, with respect to employment. Okay, so here again, we see that it's the tax upon income. We know that income is not an activity, and it can't be, and taxes, income taxes can't be a direct tax. So this has got to be an excise tax upon the income of every individual with respect to employment. Okay, everybody thinks, you know, okay, I'm an employee, I work for an employer, therefore, not so. They redefined that. So Title 11, they show their hand, and this is what it says. It's Section 1101A6. The term employee includes an officer of a corporation. Well, okay, yeah, but that means, you know, includes means like, you know, includes, you know, as the officer of a corporation as well as janitor and clerk and whatever, you know. Nope. Because in the very next section, 1101B, quote, the term includes and including when used in the definition contained in this act shall not be deemed to exclude other things otherwise within the meaning of the term defined, end quote. Now, if you do a little diagram of that sentence, you find about three double negatives. And so, so when you take out those double negatives, you're left with this. The term includes and including, when used in a definition contained herein, shall be deemed to encompass only the things listed in the term defined. Makes sense, right? So what that does is it shows you that the employee is not something you think about, and all of this goes back to the point that they can't tax your labor, because that is you have to labor in order to live. That is your right to life, right? So what they do is they use all of this thing. The Internal Revenue Code is right now somewhere around 4 million words. If they were just to say that, you know, stay within the concepts of the two classes of taxation and three categories, which, you know, the direct and the excise and the people, the property, and the activities, and you have the activity which is measured. And so even though they say it's on the measure, it's actually on the subject measured by, in this case, income. You could probably put the tax code down into 4,000 words. And then everybody would understand. And then we wouldn't have this river of money running up to Washington, D.C. that funds things like gay pride in Zimbabwe or something, whatever else, that omnibus thing that's on the floor of the House and Senate today. Anyway, all that being said, how do we use all of what I've just said to our advantage? Well, our company has figured this out. And like I said, we probably got among us two or three PhDs reading about this whole thing. And so what our company does is we go out and we form a private firm. That's what we call our product. Now, the private firm is based on a limited liability company, which limited liability companies were first legislated in 1977. And the various state governments got together and took the best parts of corporations and partnerships, which had been around for centuries, and created this new thing. So the limited liability company is an organization. It's an unincorporated organization. And if you remember back to the term partnership, you will so that the term partnership, which shall not be subject to income tax, that could be read the LLC as such shall not be subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter, period. So the best ones we found is in New Mexico. So one of our people goes down to the Secretary of State of New Mexico and organizes a limited liability company. Now, in order to do that, the application is called the Articles of Organization. It requires a minimum of two parties on it. They are the organizer and the registered agent. And here's the great thing. In New Mexico, both of those parties can be other LLCs. I'm sure we got some smart folks out there. You can see how this can be stacked and racked. It's a really cool thing. And I can pretty well assure you that some legislators got paid a lot of money to write it this way, because they don't normally give away the form. So anyway, our company has both has LLCs that fill both of these roles. So they have one of our companies is the organizer, another, a sister LLC, is the registered agent. And they have two different addresses within the state of New Mexico. So the organizer fills out the Secretary of State Articles of Organization, dips it up there, and the Secretary looks at it, stamps, and says, you're good to go, and hands us a certificate of organization. And it basically is the birth certificate of the company. And it says that you other LLCs can now do business in this new name. All right? So there's other places you can get LLCs. Three of them that are usually touted are Delaware, Nevada, and Wyoming. All right. So when you go to Organizer Incorporated in those three states, they require people's names on this list of the organizers. And those are usually known as a list of nominees. So the list is there in three states' archives, but they protect them. You know, they protect them from the IRS and other nefarious organizations. However, in New Mexico, the list does not exist. All anybody ever sees when they go to look up the companies that we build are two more companies, which are owned by two more companies, which are owned by two more companies, and a long way down the road. Right? This is all known as bulwark or cutout. So ever getting back to our clients on that public record, you can't. That's just the way it works. That's pretty cool. So then once the our company gets this new certificate of organization, one of our people who has never filed a 1040 U.S. individual income tax return and therefore is without the jurisdiction of the IRS goes to the IRS website and fills out a tax identification or fills out the application to get a tax identification number, which is known as an employer identification number, or EIN for short, for the new company. Now, when doing this, there are five choices on why is the LLC requesting an EIN. So I won't go into the other four, but the one we always choose is for banking purposes. And this is what the subheading says. Select this option if the reason for applying for the EIN is strictly, that word again, to satisfy banking requirements or local law. Do you hear anything about taxes there? Nope, because LLCs are not subject to the income tax. So once the EIN is received, then the party that's on that application is known as the sole member for this new company. And that sole member then holds a meeting of a company, of the company, and in the meeting, they make a resolution commissioning a third party as the manager of the LLC. Now, manager is the only officer of an LLC. Corporations have like president, CFO, directors, and all that stuff. Partnerships, statutory partnerships, have limited partners and general partners. But the only officer of an LLC is a manager. But the manager is, he's the hands and the feet. He's the operator thing. But you can, the company can have as many managers as it wants. Now, the company is composed of members. Members are the owners, but unlike shareholders, they don't have numbers of shares. They have percentages of membership. But you can break that percentage down to like four or five decimal places and basically have as many different members as the company wishes to have. Once all that's done, the manager takes his commission, the certificate of organization, and the EIN papers to a bank and gets this new company a checking account. And in today's world, these usually come with electronic banking and several other things that can be attached to that, but that's the basis of it. So now this new company, which has its organization papers, has a checking account. That being accomplished, the manager brings all of that stuff back to the office, and we fire up a cell phone. That's a pay-as-you-go cell phone. Here again, we're building a lot of anonymity and privacy into this product. It's as much as we've been able to possibly do. It's not perfect, but it's darn close. So we fire up this pay-as-you-go cell phone, and then we program the phone with the electronic banking, and we like to use Square App and Cash App. Because their Square is a point of sale. It provides a merchant services, and it has a checking account available to it, which is separate and distinct from the banking checking account, so that, you know, we're not putting all our eggs in one basket. And then Cash is a point of sale app, which you can also get a checking account with. So putting all that three together, it gives you, you know, more multiple avenues to run the business and make the business profitable. So once the client, and we put all this stuff in a box, ship it to the client, once the client gets it, they literally can open it up and commence to do business, which is the buying, selling, handling, or holding of goods, which is, you know, buying and selling products or services, if you will. And anywhere in the world, income tax free. Can't beat it. What are your questions?
All right. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Press star 2 on your keypad. Press star 2 to raise your hand. For those of you on Freedoms Radio, you'll see to the center right of your monitor a silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. Left-click into that, and then type away your comment or your question. And underneath, you'll see a place to put your name and some other information. I hit submit, and then I will give voice to your comment or question. First caller or question comes from Guy, New York City.
Yes,
go ahead, Guy.
Yes, sir. Mr. Slevin made mention of the website for Social Security. Very briefly, I heard of a man who actually accessed this particular website, and he briefly withdrew X amount of dollars, he had told me, to pay for some erroneous bills. The following morning, he was given a call not to do that ever again. He then checked the account, and it was back paid in full. Is there any truth to this, do you think, sir?
Yes. There's a thing called the Treasury Direct Account, which happens to be a trademark. There are ways of accessing these accounts because, remember, like I said, the account is not yours. It's the government. They set it up in the Treasury for your benefit, but they also highly benefit. When it says in the Act, it's a reserve account. Another word for reserve is escrow. So if you know anything about real estate and escrow accounts and how that works, that's exactly what they – and it's touted that there's at least $1 million put in there right off the bat, and then there's multiple investments assigned to that. However, I have personally become acquainted with multiple people that have gotten into that venue and things did not end well for them. So based on those testimonies that I've heard, I would suggest just do your business.
Go down that road.
Yeah. Well, focus on your business. And if you focus on your business using our vehicles, then you're right out of the bat. You're 40% ahead per year. Because that's about how much the income tax takes. So, yeah. And here's a little mention. Success is the greatest revenge. So don't get wrapped around the axle about how much the government has taken in the past. Go out there and be successful. That's the greatest revenge. Go ahead.
Right. Well, the question that I was putting all this together in my head, and it would appear that, we are just, it's like, it appears to me like the whole populace of America, the people itself, is an investment product for other companies to invest into the United States. My mind is just boggling right now, thinking of how much money is put into each soul that is born just because they're an American citizen. You have you can never withdraw from this account, so you're automatically making money until this person dies. And even then, after that, I'm sure.
Yeah, we were watching War Room with Steve Bannon, and one of his comments that he touts quite often is that the good faith and credit of the United States is its citizens. And so we're the engine, we're the batteries behind the motor, just like the Matrix.
Right.
Very, very good movie.
Well,
yeah, I've seen it.
I have. I was going to say that this causes me to sit and pause to think for a minute that even some of the very wealthy individuals who've been very successful within this system have no idea what is actually going on behind the scenes.
True.
I don't know how true of a statement that would be. I would think if you're going to be...
Oh, yeah, it's very true.
Wealthy,
yeah, no, I'm agreeing with you. It's very true.
And that's really the only new. what you mentioned earlier, Mr. Slevin, on... I wrote it down, darn it. On, an employee is an officer of a corporation.
Yeah.
Well, I've been paying taxes.
Or a full-time life insurance salesman. Yeah.
Yeah, I've been paying taxes for better part of 30 years. And I've never been an officer of a corporation. I'm always the guy cleaning and scrubbing the toilet. You know, why am I paying tax on this shit?
Yep.
My biggest fear is, you know, when Michael had mentioned, you know, about the refund. Now, I'm not looking for a refund, but I just certainly hope once you give me the keys to this Lamborghini, this sports car, that I will be so
Maserati.
Educated. Yeah, I was so educated where I will never make the misstep of
like any quality vehicle, it comes with operations procedures, and then you also we also have what's called our hotline services, which our clients it's for the first year. All this integration, because we build a brand new business model, is totally independent of whatever you're doing or anybody else has ever done. So this new, whatever you do today, that's your business model. So we have this brand new shiny one that is not subject to income tax, and there's a time frame of integration. All right. So that integration service, if you will, falls under the hotline services. And that is, so that's free. That's included in the price for the first year. And then it's by subscription following years for $500 a year. However, if the subscription is allowed to elapse, and then you have to call in and we need something done with the company for whatever reason, and then if it's elapsed, then we start off charging $500 an hour, and the first hour is paid up front. So
okay. All right. Well,
that's a reasonable thing.
That's a pretty expensive charge right there. But I mean, what if some attorneys? Well, I was shopping some attorneys today in Florida, and they were like $400 for an hour. I'm like, really? $400 for just
Well, it's like you get what you pay for. You can drive a Volkswagen, you can drive a Maserati. That's all.
Yeah, you make a very good point. Okay. Well, my biggest question is, you know, once I correct my status, now I have to, I want in the worst way to get the golden horseshoe, like Michael explained. Mm-hmm. I think that's just a beautiful product. In the fact that you're 100%, your family is 100%. Like Shaquille O'Neal spoke on YouTube, one of the little channels. And he was describing how, I want to be rich like you all are. Well, they're generations rich. They're going, they're so far rich. You are just momentarily rich for the first generation, maybe two, maybe three. These folks are generations, centuries deep rich. No, I don't want that kind of wealth, honestly. I don't really want
you
that.
Do. Actually, you do. Yeah, you really do, honestly. But anyway,
I don't want that kind of craziness, headache, because it'd be just too many people trying to take it from me.
Well, that's okay. But and one of the terminologies that we use for our product is called a financial interface, because if you go to a bank and you want to get a trust, it's checking account, they kind of look at you sideways, because trusts are not well known in the business community, and they've got such a bad rap from various places that things.
Yes. Yeah,
but everybody knows how a liability company works and how it, you know, what it is and like that. So it's a great interface for particularly the CRTs. And I think Michael was actually touting to getting two CRTs, and they are in place as the owners of the private firms that we supply. And so you've got double layers. You know, nobody can figure out who owns the private firm from the public record, and the
right.
CRTs are bulletproof anyway. So it makes a really good entity and interface that, as a protected individual, once you change your status, so that protects you personally. And this protects your stuff, if you will. Go ahead.
Okay, well, the question I have is, so once I correct my status, it would be just astronomically asinine to continue working in my chosen field of that I'm in, as opposed to just delving into what your product here offers. But I won't have, it's like I'll have the five first, but the, you know, seven to nine is not going to come until, you know, down towards the first part of summer.
Yeah, well, okay, so are
how
you,
am I going to get this money together for all these expenses?
Well, do you now work as an employee in the classic sense?
Yes. Okay. I'm not an officer, but my...
I know.
But typically, what
most people...
Yeah.
You have an employee-employee relationship with some company.
My vernacular definition of the word employee.
Okay.
Yes, I'm an employee.
All right. Yeah. So that way of doing business, and anytime you're buying or selling goods or services, you're doing business, okay, whether or not you are the service or not. So right now there's a contract between you, the person, and the company, whoever you're working for.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and that may or may not be written down. They say, okay, if you do X, Y, and Z, we will pay you 1, 2, 3. And you go, I agree to that and have at it. All right, and there's a lot of different things. So have you ever heard of a thing called the burden rate?
No, I have not. The burden
okay.
rate. Okay,
so long story short, the burden rate is the bottom line cost for an employee to the employer. All right, so we'll use some big round numbers. The burden rate is typically 1.5 to 1.6 times the salary. So we're going to say that you're working for IBM or whoever, and they're paying you $100,000 a year. So it's costing IBM $160,000 a year, bottom line cost for your service. That's tax, tag, title, all that stuff that goes into that thing.
Okay.
All right?
All right.
So it's a really simple negotiation. We're going to say that you purchased a new company, LLC, and you walk up to your boss and say, hey, boss, I know from my investigation that I'm costing you $160,000 a year. How would you like to pay for the same guy doing the same service and only pay $120,000 a year? That's going to get his attention right off the bat. And so you just lay it out. Instead of you're paying me X amount of dollars every month or every 2 weeks or whatever it is, moving forward, you will cut a check to New Company LLC for $10,000, and that will equal $120,000 over the year. And you will do one form, and that's called a 1099, and that 1099 will go to New Company LLC. But you get the same great guy doing the same great things in the same great time and frame and everybody reporting to all the things that you do now. It's just a little difference in paperwork. So the IBM in this example is saving 25% on my services and a whole lot of paperwork because you only have to do one form. Now, anybody that's in business will take 25% deduction or 25% reduction of their bottom line expenses and run with it. So that's the basis for that kind of negotiation. And all business is negotiation.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of understanding the truth of it and what the opposing party is really looking for, and saving 25% throughout on their labor cost. Oh yeah, in a heartbeat.
That's and on top of it, $10,000 check right then and there, bam.
Instead of taking home $100,000 or 40% off $100,000, so roughly, instead of taking home $60,000, which is what after everything is taken out you get, you're going to be taking home $120,000. Sounds like you could probably do some things with that extra or double your salary, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, and I would be totally legal because I would have changed my status.
You're done, but the LLC is operating as an interface with, in our example, IBM.
I would not I'm not sure, so real quick, I would not be able to do the LLC until I correct my status. Once I correct my status, that's when I can offer that.
And that's nonetheless, you know, it's all about, you know, yeah, we have risks and rewards, and if we want something, we go out and find the money for it, you know. Whatever that entails in your situation, you get to make that decision. It's called personal responsibility.
You're captain of your own vessel. Literally.
Exactly.
And I know. Exactly. I think Benjamin Franklin who said, you made that quote, Mr. Seven. You made that quote, Benjamin Franklin.
Oh, those who would trade liberty for liberty for safety deserve neither liberty nor safety.
Right, yes. So if you're not willing to risk a little risk and you have to be very comfortable with the table scraps that you get for your security.
You know, yep.
That's how I look at it. And the table scraps that they're giving are
just that.
Now, you may mention one last thing, and someone else ask a question. You had mentioned, while it is probably very feasible and plausible to get back your old taxes that you paid into the system.
No.
Which would probably
no. And the way they wrote it up in their legalese is that any money that you hand to the government, where you think you're paying a tax or not, the government considers it a gift. And they don't allow Indian givers. You can't take a gift back. And if you try, if it does not go well. But so that's why I put into it, the best revenge is success. So whatever's happened, it's under the bridge, and you get out there and get fully successful. And in our example, you know, you're taking home double what you were taking home. That's pretty freaking successful in anybody's book.
Right. Well, you made that like a very good point. Don't go that route with the account that this other person said that he had and tried to take the money out of the account, even though he managed to walk away from that. Okay. You said that it could be disastrous. I could do it. And then you would not be protected by the law at all. You would be.
Nope.
Oh. Okay. That pretty much sums it up. It wraps it up for me. Thank you very much for the show. I really appreciate your efforts. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
All right, again, press star 2, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hand. Press star 2. We've got some first-time callers here. I'm surprised you're not jumping on board with some questions here. Next is Michael from Las Vegas, Nevada. Go ahead, Michael.
Good evening. You were talking about the Treasury Direct account. You're the beneficiary of that account.
The qualified individual is the beneficiary.
The qualified,
but it's not like a trust. The word beneficiary is it's not the same. They don't use it the same way. Okay, it's an account. And you benefit from the payments, but you're not the beneficiary in technical terms. And I apologize for being very technical, but in this venue, it matters. So what else?
Well, it all goes back to 1933 bankruptcy. And they plainly state in it that they take everything, land, buildings, animals, equipment, can't take the people. But they took the people's labor through fraud, of course.
Agreed.
And because they're not entitled to that labor. But they plainly stated that they take the people's labor. Because to take the people would be slavery, and they could go to, they could be hung for slavery.
Well, but it's the difference in involuntary servitude and voluntary servitude. By filling out forms like the certificate of birth or birth record, the birth record certification and the SS-5 income tax, Social Security application, then you effectively become a slave of D.C., and slaves cannot own property, so whatever they produce is not theirs.
Well, they did all that in fraud, too, because there was no insurance agent or CPA to explain to you and give you a three-day notice or a venue to accept or deny. And they know that. But you're right. It's water under the bridge. Just go forward. And don't. I've known people, one person that tried to go back to take it into the courts to get the money. And I told him, I said, that's not exactly the road you want to go, but if you want to go, they're going to come at you.
Yeah, they do.
And I guess they did, because I haven't heard from him in 3 years.
Yep.
Forward we go. Backward, all we do is get mired in the mud.
Success is the best revenge.
All right. Well, I just wanted to throw that in there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael. Cameron, go ahead. Van Nuys, California, guys. Go ahead.
Yeah. My question, I thought it was covered earlier with the first guy, but I just want to make absolutely sure. So are we saying that we got to correct our status as American State National before we actually open up the LLC with your service?
No. No, our product is entirely independent of anybody else's circumstances or situation. Okay.
Okay.
So it really is a standalone, and it's a very good first step, because once you're working under that umbrella, and it's not subject to the income tax, then you become income tax immune, if you will, because and it's. As in not subject to or not liable for, I'm working under that umbrella. And so it's a great first step. And, you know, compared to the whole of the, of Michael's offerings, if you will, it's a very affordable first step. But yeah, you can also do this and as a quote unquote side hustle. And then keep your little W-2 job over there. And, you know, and as far as the government's concerned, you're a good little taxpayer over there. But I've got multiple clients that have been running running their business, which the IRS never talks to, and making in excess of six figures every year. And then they've got their little day job and they pay they pay their tribute over there, and they get left alone, and they got this enterprise out back that's just going great guns. One of my clients paid his daughter wanted to go to Alabama, and he paid her full boat, 4 year ride, books, everything out of that business, and alongside his little W-2 job.
So I guess there's a case, something versus Hinkle, where we have the ability to have unlimited contracts. So you can contract as a surety, as a person, you know, for the person, or you can also do the LLC. But you can do both sides of the fence is what you're saying.
Yeah. Because our private firms, a.k.a. based on an LLC, are entirely distinct and legal identities from you or anybody else and or their members or management. So what it does, it does. And it's what it does is entirely immune to the income tax. And that's a wholly separate thing from what you do now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so your package, what does everything include for the price that you're charging? What is all included? What's the total price? What's it include exactly? What is the client getting?
Okay, the price is $7,500, and you get an LLC duly formed in the state of New Mexico by other LLCs which it has an EIN and it gets a checking account, and then you get a phone that's got other financial accounts ready to go on there. There's some things that you have to do with it, but that's just details. So, and you get the phone, and the phone is paid up for X amount of time frame. So that's the basis of the structure. You know, other things can be added if, you know, in your particular scenario, and then get it all together, and then we interface it with you, you know, at the best, you know, we never give advice, but we assist and we suggest what we believe to be beneficial tactics and techniques for your situation.
Got it. So, you know, on this, so it's a cell phone, right? I mean, why not just be a client be able to use their own cell phone? Why a separate phone for that particular service?
Okay, one of the tenets of anonymity is keeping yourself separate. Okay, so one of the things you do is you don't have your mail delivered where you sleep. And
okay.
So if you've got a separate and distinct entity out here doing business that in no way in the public record is tied to you, then why would you want to use stuff that is tied to you, like a cell phone contract, to operate that business?
I see. So it's basically do not co-mingle.
That's another word. Yep. That's a good word. And having a separate device to run the business on. And to have, you know, that runs, you know, separate device, separate emails, all this stuff is separate. It's, you know, it's a distinct entity from you.
Okay.
In our organizations. And that's why we do it that way. And we've been doing this close to 20 years. So I'm pretty sure we got it down.
Okay. That makes sense. And so the bank account that you're referring to, is that something that you guys set up for a bank that you recommend, or is it through our own local bank?
We do everything. When you open the box, you got it. You can shift it into gear and run with it. Or we sometimes like to say, you know, it's we hand you a starship, but how fast it goes and where it goes is entirely up to you.
And is that bank account on a private side, or is it on a public side?
It is with a typical FDIC bank.
Okay, so it's public. Okay. Okay, and then you get the debit card. So I can see why there's a separate phone, just basically keep everything separate. Okay, I think that was my question. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you. Let's check with anyone else. Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen. Press star 2. Raise your hand while you're thinking about doing that. I'm going to check Freedom's Radio. And if nobody's there raising their hand when I get back, then we're going to call it a night. Let's see what we got here. No one raised their hand there. Press and refresh here. Hey, Miss Jennifer Sue, how do you do?
I am pretty good. Now, what if there is a raw milk farm? And they've been doing it forever, and they all of a sudden to set their whole business up differently, would that be a scary situation? Because, you know, the government always has to come and check the bloody cows and the milk and, you know, all of this stuff. Would they be able to tell them we don't want you to anymore? And then, even though they might come and shut them down. And like, would there be any issue for such?
Right, so as I understand your question, you've got some type of farming operation, and your commercial interface is your local banker, and it's called your farm or whatever. And so now you want to use the private firm as the commercial interface between the farm and the business world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. We can assist you in doing that. And it doesn't have to be overnight. It doesn't have to be scary. It's a matter of, okay, there's certain specific things concerning revenue and expenses of the business and where that cash flows, if you will. and we just put it into a new vehicle. As far as what the local county agent or whatever may have to do with the farm, that doesn't have anything to do with the finances of the farm and what the cash flow is, as far as I know.
No,
I mean,
no, but it's very, you know, people don't, the government don't like anyone buying raw milk. And they have to have their milk, like they have inspectors come all the time, and, you know, they just may not even tell them they're coming to test things, and there's just things that they have to do according to whatever the government says. You have to do this. Like,
well, yeah, but
sudden,
that's part of the operations of the farm. Okay, that has nothing to do with the financial portions of the, or the interface, if you will, between the farm and the business world.
Oh, I see. So it's not really to do with jurisdiction or anything. It's more to do with just, you don't have to pay
cash
taxes
flow.
The way it's set
yeah,
up.
It, the easiest word is cash flow.
I see.
You get more. You basically with our vehicle, you get more coming in than is going out. That's always a good thing.
Right. Okay. I just have to talk him into it now. All right.
Yeah, that'd be a good deal.
Well, thanks for that. All right.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you so much, Jennifer Sue. And to last on the call will be Guy, and then we're going to go home. Go ahead, Guy.
Oh, yes. Guys, thanks again for taking the call and the question. Real quick, Mr. Seven and Michael, once the status is corrected, the last question I have really is, will I still be able to collect my Social Security, my pension from the union, any 401k funds that I may have floating around there? Will I still be allowed to have that and receive that money back from
the Okay, the Social Security Administration and the benefits thereof is a separate and distinct contract from anything else. The short answer to that is yes. As far as the pension, you may have, that is based on what you have done in the past, and that is a contract just like everything else. And so whatever that contract says is the truth. And so is it because you change the motif of doing business, that should have no effect on that contract. However, you got to read the contract, okay? Because in civil discourse, the contract makes the law. All right. So you said Social Security and pension. There was a third thing. Oh, 401k. Here again, that's another contract. You've got money put away, and the 401 refers to a section out of the Internal Revenue Code, and so it usually has, there's a custodian of the 401 account, and you know, and whatever that contract is with you and the custodian, as far as the accessing those funds, is what you get to look at.
With all due respect, you know, the reason why I ask that is because the biggest thing here, the biggest kicker, is Uncle Sam getting his tax money, in his blood money, for, you know, holding those funds for you for so long. You know, he wants his cut, he wants his share. So if I'm not paying tax on, you know, my Social Security and or my pension, I think he's going to be a little irate. You know.
Well,
I mean,
I really don't care.
No, I don't either. I really, really don't either. However,
yeah.
I just wanted to make sure that it sounds like
fight. This contract. It's all contracts. You just got to know the contract, and a lot of the contract is on fine print. Okay, and just to show you how fine print can be, the next time you pull out one of your checks, and that you're going to write to somebody like the power company, get a really good magnifying glass and look at that, what looks like a line that you sign on. That's not a line. That's text, and that is fine print.
Are you shitting me? Oh, my God. No,
No, sir. I do not do that.
Oh, yeah. I know. I'm real good. What the? Oh, shit.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Very good.
All right. Mr. Slevin, Michael, thank you very much for the wonderful education tonight. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. I want to thank everyone for coming tonight, especially Mr. Slevin. I hope you got your questions answered. I'm glad that some first-time callers here get to hear what this is about. Till next week, I want to remind you that Saturday is when Justice Beshear returns, and we'll talk about, quote, the ultimate in asset protection. .com. And that's the Saturday night call. Then, of course, Monday we return with GW. Tuesday, prayerfully, John will be returning. And Wednesday will be Mr. Slevin again, Herr Slevin. So until then, good night, everyone. And be well.
Good night.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you.